This is Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today, we feature a panel discussion held last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics that takes a look at 2019 legislative priorities from an environmental perspective. Air quality, renewable energy, land conservation, water policy, those are just a few of the topics addressed by panel members on today's show. And on that panel, Carly Farrow, Associate Organizing Representative from the Utah Chapter of the Sierra Club, Noah Materko, Grassroots Organizer for Keo Utah, Zach Frankel, Executive Director of the Utah Rivers Council, and moderating the discussion today is Jayla Lundstrom from University Water Warriors. Today's forum was recorded on January 14th, 2019. To begin, panel members introduce themselves and offer a glimpse into the organizations they represent. Starting first is Noah Materko of Heal Utah.
Thanks so much for having me today. I'm always stoked to come up and see such a packed room. So I work for Heal Utah. I'm the grassroots organizer over there. If you're not familiar with Heal Utah, we're a small environmental policy nonprofit. We began about 20 years ago. This is actually our 20th anniversary. We work in three main campaign areas, probably best known these days for working on clean air, but additionally we work on nuclear toxic waste threats and also clean energy, so that transition from dirty coal to renewable energy. And we try to accomplish those things through working through smart policy with lawmakers and regulators, but also connecting the community with these sometimes really complicated public processes. So making sure that people know what's going on and that you do have a voice and really making that connection between those two things. So thanks again.
My name is Zach Frankel. As Jayla said, I'm the executive director of the Utah Rivers Council. And we're a nonprofit here in Utah. We've been around for about 25 years now, working on water issues, river protection, watershed protection, water conservation, and at the State House for almost that entire time. So thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here today. I love seeing some familiar faces that I've seen in our volunteer offices. I'm Carly Farrow. I'm an organizing representative, it's quite a mouthful, with the Utah Sierra Club, as well as with the National Sierra Club, working on a campaign called Our Wild America, focusing on the protection of lands, water, and wildlife. So you may have heard of Sierra Club before. We're the largest grassroots organization in the nation with over 3.5 million supporters and members. We are your local Utah chapter working on dedicated to exploring, enjoying, and protecting life outside here in Utah. We are a fairly small staff of an environmental policy organization, similarly working to protect lands, water, and wildlife here in Utah, as well as another campaign area that we work on is renewable energy. And we also work in the political sphere, making sure we have a PAC, it's called the Political Action Committee, working to support and endorse candidates while also working at the state legislature to protect environmental policies for the people and for the environment. So thanks so much for having us here today.
Thank you all. And Zach is going to give us a brief overview on the legislative session in general, just to get you all up to speed on how that process works. So thank you, Zach, and thank you all for being here today.
Thank you very much. I wanted to talk a little bit about how the legislature works, because the three of us up here have been doing this for a long time, and we work with a lot of people every legislative session. And there's always a couple of fundamental things that we struggle to convey, no matter what bill we're working on. So there's four rules, as I see it, to understand how the legislative session works. So let's run through them. So when people come to the legislature and they come to us, they think that they have to be experts on something or everything. They especially think they have to be experts on legislative process. But that's actually not the truth. The first rule is that lobbying is very, very simple. You don't have to be an expert about everything happening in that building. In fact, most of it is just very, very basic. It's about people coming to talk to their legislators as constituents to express their opinion. And when it comes to legislative process, there's really only a few things happening. There's a lot of complication on top of it, but it's fundamentally the same old thing you saw in Schoolhouse Rock. It's about how a bill becomes a law. If you guys haven't seen it, I know that's like five generations ago. But it's very simple. A bill is introduced, okay, and it's heard in a committee. And then that's where it's presented. That's where the only chance is for the public to debate and provide some input, if they get any. All right. And then if the committee likes the bill, they'll vote it out of committee, or they will vote it down and it won't get out of committee. If it gets out of committee, then it will go back to the floor. So if it was a House bill, it will go to a House committee, and then it'll go back to the House floor. All right, if it's a Senate bill, it will go to a Senate committee, and then it will go to the Senate floor. All right, if it passes that floor vote, that House floor vote, then it'll go over to the opposite chamber. So again, if it's a House bill, it will go to the House floor, and then it will go over to a Senate committee and repeat the process. If it passes that Senate committee, it will go to the Senate floor, vice versa. That's it. And then if the governor doesn't veto it, if he doesn't veto it, he doesn't actually sign all the bills, he just vetoes the ones that he doesn't want to pass, which this governor uses his veto very sparingly, then it becomes a law. That's it. That's really about all you need to know. You can know more, but you don't have to be an expert about what happens in that committee. And the other thing is there's about 5 to 10 legislators in each one of those committees. There's 38 votes you need on the House to vote go your way, and there's 15 votes you need in the Senate, of course, because there's 29 senators, all right? So you need a majority of 15, and I think there's, what, 75 House members? So you need 38 voting your way. That's pretty much it. So that's rule number one. Rule number two, this is marathon. It's not a sprint. Everybody wants to get really excited about sprinting to this 45-day session, but it's a bit nutty up there. The thing to think about is this is a lifelong relationship with your legislators, not just about one issue, but about any and all issues you are going to care about, because your vote matters. Your opinion matters, all right? So those are the first two rules. Let's talk about why this is a marathon. So what you're looking at here is just the basically months of the year divided by a white line, and you'll see that they're on the one side of this screen is the 45-day legislative session, all right? 45 days. So that's the regular session. It starts January 28th this year, all right? But the legislature, those committees, meet all year round. That's called the interim session. So from April into December, those committees keep meeting, and they're much easier to participate in, and here's why, okay? Obviously, there's 325 days in the interim session. Really easy for you guys to go talk to your legislators. Very, very easy, okay? And let's take a hypothetical committee. I like the box thinking committee. So the box thinking committee meets once a month, all right? And so they will meet once a month in the interim session. They might meet 5 times. They might meet 6 times, okay? During the regular session, they'll meet every 3 days. And so you can see in a 45-day period, in a 6-week session, the box thinking committee might meet 10 or 12 or 15 times. It's very hard to affect such a busy schedule during the regular session, all right? During the interim session, it's really easy to get to speak at that committee meeting. So we're talking June, July, August, September, October. It's not very hard to get in front of that committee. And you get 30 days in between the committee meetings in the interim session, and during the regular session, you only get 3 days. So the point of all of this is that if you get engaged after the regular session, you will have a lot more time to affect your legislator's opinion, a lot more time. And that's a delight, all right? So rule number three, lobbying is much easier before or after the regular session. Now, we're not trying to dissuade you against getting involved in the regular session. Please, please do. The three of us are here today to talk about how you can get involved. But a lot of the legislative issues will continue after the regular session, pretty much all of them. So the other thing that's really different between the two sessions, in the interim session, there might be 70 to maybe 150 bills heard during that interim 7-8 month period, okay? During the 45-day session, it's not uncommon for these guys to evaluate over 1,000 bills. 1,000 bills. So put yourself in the lobby, in the legislator's shoes. If you have to vote on 1,000 bills, think about how much information that is to read, especially when you're going to two committees a day, which each one might take 2 hours, and then you've got floor time, which is going to take 2 hours, and you're trying to respond to all of your constituents. Oh, and by the way, on the side, you got to read 1,000 pieces of legislation. And yeah, you know, all of you are an expert on something. And so the bills that come up that you're an expert on, whatever that issue is, so for me, right, it's water. The water bills are the ones I want to read. All the other things, I'm like, I don't know anything about Medicaid. So if you're a legislator and you want information, an opinion about a bill you don't know anything about, who do you go to? Who can answer this for me? Who are you going to go to for information about a bill you don't know anything about? Right there, a lobbyist. You're going to walk outside of the floor and you're going to see a lobbyist or a constituent and you say, oh, Zach, I'm so glad you're here. Do you know anything about House Bill, blah, blah, blah? I don't know anything about it. I don't have time to read it. It's 30 pages long. Can you check it out for me? That happens again and again and again. So if you're a constituent talking to your legislator, they will ask you for your opinion if you are respectful to them. Okay, so that's the third rule. All right? So there's one more rule, which is basically an extension of that, which is legislators don't know much about the legislation they vote on. That's not criticism. That's just the reality. They're going to be experts on something. They might be experts on a bunch of things, but they're not going to be an expert on everything. And so that's why what you want to do is build a relationship that hopefully lasts a lifetime with that legislator or whoever that legislative representative is. So pretty much that's the four rules. Bill's introduced, goes to a standing committee. The only addition to that is which standing committee it goes to is a function of the rules committee. So it's another committee and another group of legislators you can influence. And that's pretty much it. It goes to the floor. If it passes the floor, goes to the other body's rule committee, goes to the that body standing committee, wherever it goes, goes to that floor. And so you can see it's pretty simple. That's all there is to it. The rest of it is just what is the issue. And if you want to invest in learning about the issue, that's what the three of us are here for. Our organizations represent different aspects of focusing on different bills that we are caring about. And sometimes we know what the bills are coming up to the legislative session, but a lot of time there's a lot of surprises that come up in the middle of the session. So if you're interested in being involved in the legislature in the 45-day session, stay involved all the way into March, because we will have a lot of dark horses that come out and we haven't seen before until mid-February. And those are the bills that we can't talk about right now because we don't know what they are, all right? But that's pretty much it. Now you guys are legislative experts. So I want to shift now the next session and section and just talk about a couple of bills we know about right now really quickly. Senate Bill 52, if people are interested in water, is a really important water metering bill. It's a little bit technical, but it's the concept that putting meters on our bill, on the pipes that we are using water from is a good thing, because there's this kind of water use in our cities called secondary water that is completely unmetered. No one knows. The end users have no idea how much water they're using. And so Senator Anderegg has a bill, SB 52, to just install meters on our secondary water use, especially across northern Utah, which accounts for a huge quantity of water. Now, I know it's funny to say there's a huge quantity of water, but it's unmetered, but we're talking about the water use for a city of probably 800,000 people in these secondary meters, and the users are completely unmetered. They have no idea how much water they're using, and so his bill would require meters to be installed. And that's one piece of legislation. The other piece of legislation, we want to see SB 52 pass. This bill, we want to see
not pass. So this is the concept of this bill, which is SB 17, is that cities should be allowed to regulate their water quality. Okay, basic concept. Cities should be allowed to protect their water quality upstream of the city boundary, right? So like cities' water, the drinking water for the residents in this city, comes from, among other places, the Cottonwood Canyons. But the Cottonwood Canyons are outside the city boundary of Salt Lake City, right? But people shouldn't be allowed to pollute the Cottonwood Canyons just because the city can't regulate the water quality up there, right? SB 17 is an overreach. It would limit the ability of cities to regulate their water quality upstream of their city boundaries. It was presented by Representative Mike Noel last year. He has since retired from the legislature, but this bill continues forward. It starts in the Senate under SB 17, and we'd just like to see this bill stop. The ability that the cities have today to regulate their watersheds upstream of their city boundaries was established 120 years ago by previous generations of Utah elected officials who said water quality is a good thing and we should let cities regulate their water quality upstream. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk about a handful of bills. The first few will be about air quality, and then I'll talk about an important piece of energy legislation. So air pollution is probably the preeminent environmental issue in a lot of people's minds for northern Utah. And you look out today and you see the inversions. And a lot of that comes from a natural phenomenon of our geography, the cold air sinks and everything we spit out there pollution-wise sticks around until a storm comes through and blows it out. And it's a tough reality of living in Salt Lake. But it's important to know where that pollution comes from and what can be done about it. So about 48% of the air pollution during the wintertime inversions, 48% of that comes from transportation. So all of our cars out on the road, everything, industry, residential, all of that is about 48%, which is huge. And then about 25%, I think, comes from buildings and homes. So just buildings like this, which are, this one's probably super efficient, which is good. But and the rest comes from heavy industry, so refineries and things like that. And everybody, it's easy to point at the refineries and say, shut these down and we'll be better, but that's not the reality of the situation. The reality is that we're going to address the air pollution problem through personal behavior and through smart policy. So the first bill I'm going to talk about is called the Free Fair Day Bill. Does anybody remember last year? I think it was right before Christmas, all the UTA tracks, front runner, and buses were free for the whole day. Does anybody participate in that? Well, I did, and it was great. And it was a huge spike in ridership, and it was a great little experiment. And the conclusion was that if we want to get people off of, or out of their vehicles more often and into public transportation, we have to remove barriers. And one of those barriers is cost. And people don't think about buses being expensive, but if you're a mother or father of children and there's four of you and you got to go to the grocery store, and that adds up real quick. It's like $250 to get on the bus. That's a lot. So there's that cost barrier. So this bill would create a certain amount of days that are just free on all UTA systems for a handful of days during our wintertime inversion season. So December, January, February, free days. And the hope is to get people off the roads in their cars and onto the buses, and to get people who have maybe never taken the bus before, to get them in the bus and help change that personal behavior. So that could be a big one. We're really excited about that. Another bill we're working on is called illegal tampering, and this is more widely known as coal rolling. So maybe you're driving around your hybrid or you're biking and someone drives by and shoots out stacks of black smoke seemingly at will. That comes from illegally tampering with pollution controls in the vehicles. It's obnoxious, and we know that when diesel engines are out of compliance for air pollution, they're polluting many more times than a vehicle that's in compliance. So there's potentially a lot of pollution right there. And currently, coal rolling is illegal, but it's effectively unenforceable. So what this bill would do, it would create a more effective reporting mechanism and streamline the process in order to dissuade people from doing that. So that's an interesting one as well. And another one I'm going to talk about is appropriations. So it's not necessarily a bill, but many of you may have heard that Governor Herbert has committed $100 million in appropriations to address air quality, which is huge. It's a lot of money. And the goal is to reduce Salt Lake's air pollution by 25% by the year 2026. So if you imagine that, that is pretty incredible, and there's a lot of work to do. But that money has to be spent the right way. And there's a lot of negotiating that will happen during this legislative session to appropriate where that money goes. And HEAL has a handful of things that we would like to see that money go towards in order to be most effective. One of those things would be a wood stove changeout program. So there's currently 110,000 wood-burning stoves along the Wasatch Front, which is a huge amount. Wood pollution that comes from burning wood has a lot of that particulate matter that makes up our wintertime pollution problem. So that source right there is 12 to 15% of the wintertime air pollution contribution. So an exchange program would allow people to exchange those for electric or more efficient heaters. And this would also serve a double good purpose, because a lot of people who do use wood burning stoves are of lower income, and that's just kind of what they do. So this would be something that would have a more tangible effect for people who have low income and helping them exchange that. Snow blowers and lawnmowers are huge polluters as well. An exchange program for that would be good. There's 60 locomotives down at the rail yards that run 24/7. They're called freight switchers. And these things, there's just 60 of them, but they contribute 7% of our wintertime air pollution, which is huge also. So we'd like to get those replaced. Well, now I'm going to pivot to energy. And this is pretty wonky, but if pulled off successfully, it could be really huge for Utah's energy sector and for climate and renewable stuff going forward. So the bill is called Energy Production Financing Amendments, but it will be more frequently referred to as securitization. So this has to do with power plants and our main utility, Rocky Mountain Power, and other utilities as well. But just as a background, in order to produce reliable energy, utilities invest billions of dollars into their power plants. So this is a secure investment, because the utility is guaranteed that ratepayers, people like us, will continue to pay a return on this investment throughout the life of that power plant. But eventually, the power plant reaches a certain point where it's no longer economic for the utility and the ratepayers putting money into it. But if you can't just shut down a power plant for no reason, that's a huge economic loss for the utility. It also creates electricity spikes for ratepayers, displace workers, and be really harmful for local communities that really rely on these power plants. So securitization is a tool that would help address all these areas. The amendment would implement a low-risk financing tool to help utilities transition from old uneconomic power generation to modern economic generation, with the opportunity for community reinvestment. So in that legislation, there'd be a package of money that would go to reinvest into the community that could potentially be losing a major employer. Securitization takes the power plant's debt payment, which ratepayers have been paying into, and gives it to a financial institution as an asset. And this financial institution takes over the payments and bonds against the asset in the form of millions of dollars, which the utility then receives and uses to modernize and switch to a new source of energy. So this has been pretty wonky, and thanks for sticking with me on this one. But basically, this would be a way to transition to more economic and cleaner energy without a huge economic hit for the utility, the ratepayers, and the communities involved. So that could be, we'll have to see where this goes, but it's a potentially very powerful tool that would help move Utah in the right direction as far as renewable energy. And those are my bills. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Carly here with Sierra Club. As I mentioned before, Sierra Club's working on a whole suite of issues that span the environmental spectrum. So just to give you a little bit of insight, you know, we are looking on the Utah legislative website daily and have a whole host of keywords, like 50 to 100 different keywords that we're looking for in legislation to protect life outside here in Utah. So that's a daily, we're checking bills, seeing what language is, and one of our major priorities during the session is to be collaborative. So we have some really great organizations right here up here with us, as well as organizations outside. You know, the environmental community here in Utah is fairly small. So working collaboratively across the different issues to make sure that we are in the know and informing legislators about all the different issues that are upcoming in this session to make sure we're protecting public health as well as the environmental landscape. So that's a huge piece, and that's also where a lot of you come in, coming up and coming and lobbying with us throughout the session. So as I mentioned, we are looking for bills that impact lands, water, wildlife, energy, and air, and do lean on our partners a lot for their specific niche issues. One of the big things that we're looking for is that we know not all bills are cut and dry. Sometimes there's language that we really, really support, and then other times there's not. So during the 2019 legislative session, there will be an update to building codes. And Noah mentioned on some of the air quality emissions that we see, how the breakup is. And according to the Utah Division of Air Quality, buildings comprise 38% of our wintertime particulate matter 2.5. So that's the 2.5 microns, super tiny, impacts lungs and long-term health impacts. And so that makes them a critical target for future improvements to our airshed. And there's two parts that's built. The first part we really love. We love seeing that commercial energy codes will adopt a full suite of recommendations that will translate to an 8% reduction in energy cost. And that for the residential energy code, we're seeing partial alignment that will be increasing requirement for 90% of efficiency lighting. But then we're also seeing, again, this doesn't have a bill number yet, so this is still somewhat of a rumor, but we do anticipate this coming out, that our natural gas utility, Dominion Energy, is pushing for an amendment to this bill that would rescind the requirements for ultra-low nitrous oxide water heaters, undoing requirements that would increase nitrous oxide emissions, which contribute dramatically to our wintertime inversions. And by adopting these low NOx, ultra-low NOx water heaters, this rule would help reduce source emissions by 35% by 2024. So we want to see an increase, an update to the building codes, but we don't want to see it at the cost of a rule rescission that would further impact our air quality. We're also seeing some legislation that's on its face seemingly really good, but some of the language creates some contradictory actions that could impact us. So there's a bill that wants to tell to minimize climate change impacts by pursuing policies to reduce carbon emissions. That sounds awesome and wonderful and great, and we definitely want that. But in there's some language that's working toward reducing restrictions for a push to salvage logging before timber loses its economic value. And we fear that this might be an opportunity to leverage support for the state's attempt to exempt it from the roadless rule. And the roadless rule protects national forest lands, areas that get an extra level of protection that'll prohibits building roads as well as prohibits commercial logging or big logging practices, protecting really critical areas, 4 million acres here in Utah that are critical for our watersheds, our drinking water, and actually do help with wildfire mitigation. So as I said, not all bills are cut and dry. We're also anticipating some bill that would attempt to weaken Proposition 4, which would help with redistricting of gerrymandered Utah. So we're definitely keeping our eyes and ears open to see, make sure that we uphold Prop 4 so we can see some redistricting to make sure that our political representation represents the demographic of Utah truly. So those are some things, and like I said, we're tracking all of these different bills, and we do have a priority bill tracker that once we're headed into the session on January 28th, will be available on our website, and I have handouts here, and it's a really cool tool. I can talk more about it later, but it makes these policies really digestible, lets you know where the Sierra Club stands, where it lies on priorities, a link to the bill, as well as like where it is. Is it in committee? Has it gone to the House? So that way you're able to identify who's most effective to contact at this point in time for a particular bill. So that's that. Thanks.
That's Carly Farrow, Associate Organizing Representative from the Utah Chapter of the Sierra Club. And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today, we are airing a panel discussion held last week featuring the Utah Environmental Community's priorities for the state's upcoming legislative session. Here's today's moderator, Jayla Lundstrom.
Great. Thank you, Zach, Noah, and Carly for that. That was really informative. So I'm here with University Water Warriors. We are a student advocacy group on campus that encourages students to get involved in water-related issues as well as other environmental issues. We work under Utah Rivers Council with Zach. And on behalf of the organization, I have some questions for you all. First of all, as a student group, I want to know, what role do students play in advocacy and advocating on environmental issues in particular, and how important is our voice?
Boy, students are critical, in my mind, for advocacy, because we find students a little more willing to disagree with elected officials than a lot of people are older in life. We love engaging students because we have found that when we get students engaged in the political process, they're more likely to stay engaged than if we try and recruit people that are older to the process for the first time ever later in life. And so we have a lot of student projects. We have internships as well, incidentally, which I can pitch, I guess, afterwards. But we love having students involved in projects. And so our real thing is to try and get students up to the legislature. All three of the organizations up here do a really good job of engaging students, in my mind, at the session. And the one thing we all seem to find is we bring students up there and we teach them how to lobby really quickly, and they start doing it, and they almost invariably decide it's fun. They thought it was a responsibility or that they should, and they get up there and they have a good time. And I've literally had almost every session somebody comes up to me and is after a successful day of lobbying, and they'll literally ask permission. They'll literally say, "Can I please come again?" You know, and like, it's up to me. And so that really is, I mean, the thing is, we keep talking about all this stuff, but the reality of the situation is, it's fun to do. It's empowering. People realize, wow, I actually have influence over this process.
Thanks, Zach. Yeah, it can't be overstated how incredibly important the engagement of students and young people is. And I mean, when young people, voters or not, are checked out or asleep at the wheel, we can have some really disastrous election cycles and outcomes and things like that. And I think a lot of people have been galvanized the last couple of years to really come to action. And just on a more day-to-day note, if you come up to the Capitol and you talk to a representative, they will listen to you. When they see a college student, they know that the University of Utah is an economic engine and that everybody in this room is potentially the future of this valley. And as much as it hurts that we can't get a lot of these representatives to bite on the environmental tagline, when it comes to economics, they really bite. And when they see you up there, they know that you're representing the future of the economy in Utah. And honestly, they see us every day and they get sick of seeing us. And like Zach mentioned earlier, even if you're not an expert on the issue, you probably know more than they do. And at that point, you become a resource to them. And at a certain point, they're relying on citizen lobbyists and young people to fill them in on the issue. And if they don't hear from you, they don't know about the issue, and they'll just vote how a lobbyist tells them or how their peers vote, and that's a potential loss as far as the issues that you may be concerned about. So it's super important, and part of our jobs at our organizations is to make it as easy as possible for you to get up there and get civically engaged. So after this, feel free to join us at the Capitol.
Yeah, and I'll echo that students are critical. I don't know if anyone remembers last year, House Concurrent Resolution 007. Student Climate Resolution. That was brought by students to representatives, helped drafted with students, and then students were up there lobbying. Yeah, some of our organizations were supportive and helping to foster that curiosity and that desire, but that was all students. And that was such a pivotal piece. That was the legislature accepting that climate change is real and that it's human caused. And that was the student success. So I'd say beyond just coming up there and lobbying with us, I get suggestions from students about other legislation we should be pushing. So, I am open to that, and we welcome that. We have a Utah Youth Environmental Solutions Network, which I see some students here that have participated in some of those meetings. And those, you are the future. So you bringing ideas and new opportunities to us and asking us how you can help push that through, that's what we want to do. So I'd say students are more than just assisting us. They're creating the spaces and creating the new opportunities for the future of Utah's environment. So I think you're absolutely critical and lots of ways to get involved. And also, we love your suggestions. Honestly, I love when students are like, hey, I want to start this campaign. That's happened, and that's moving forward. So with your little push, you're inspiring us to do more and help you do more. So it's important.
Thank you all. And just a little plug as well, University Water Warriors is a group of students who you can come hang out with, basically, and we'll go up on the Capitol and help you advocate for any of these issues that you care about. So that's a resource as well if you don't want to go up there alone. I have a question about what happened during the 2018 legislative session. What passed and what didn't, and what were the implications, and what were the lessons learned from last year?
Well, yeah, I'll take this first. I have our nice little legislative session update from 2018. I think, I don't know if most people knew, but they tried to do a Donald J. Trump Utah National Parks Highway. That was defeated. So I think that's really awesome. there was also a bill that passed last year that was an air quality emissions testing amendment. This created a new diesel emissions testing pilot program in Utah County. And hopefully, if that's deemed successful, that can permeate beyond Utah County and filter into different areas. Of course, there is HCR 7, Concurrent Resolution on Environmental and Economic Stewardship, which, again, like I said, accepted that climate change was real and was human caused, and that was the Utah legislature claiming that. So that's really, really important. Do you want to add some pieces?
You covered a good amount of those. The climate change resolution, that is incredibly important. But, you know, in itself, it's not binding. It acknowledges, written in the code now, that we see climate change is happening and we have to do something about it. So that's going to be a really great tool going forward. So I think we're pretty thrilled about that. Some of the defeats we had last year at the legislative session, like Zach mentioned earlier, some of these bills come out of nowhere, and sometimes they can come out of nowhere because there is a lot of money spent on keeping it secret and then making it successful. So we saw a couple of bad bills having to do with our friends out at Energy Solutions in Tooele. They're a radioactive waste facility. That's where they house radioactive waste from decommissioned nuclear power plants and all types of stuff like that. So we had a couple things that on their face didn't look so bad, and we thought they were going someplace bad, and they did. So it's lessons learned there. But I think overall it was a pretty decent session.
The only bill that I think I would mention would be the extraterritorial jurisdiction, this idea that cities protecting their water quality upstream of their boundaries is a quote-unquote overreach, some kind of overregulation. And so it was really sad to see that bill not die. Everybody hated it. All the cities and towns hated it. Even the water districts hated it. And so yet it went into interim, and now it's back. So that one's really a dread. We really could have dirtier water if that bill advances, especially if it gets altered and made worse than it is today. So we're pretty worried about that thing. Hopefully the fact that Representative Mike Noel is no longer a representative, it won't advance, but that's our big concern.
Great, thank you. And then this question has to do with what will happen in the future. So in a perfect world, during the 2019 legislative session, what has to happen to get these bills passed or stopped, and what are the implications of these bills passing or being stopped? What would you say needs to happen and take place, though, to make that change?
Well, every legislative session is a learning experience, and what we've learned over the past few years is that it takes strong, broad coalitions of groups who might not necessarily consider themselves environmentalists or anything like that. It takes all types of people coming together and lobbying on all angles, essentially. So in a perfect world, all the good bills would pass this year and all the bad bills would die, and this $100 million would be spent in a really smart and effective way. And part of one of the problems with air quality or air pollution problem in the Valley is we have the Division of Air Quality and the DEQ and all these regulatory bodies that are supposed to be regulating this, but they don't, honestly, a lot of them are underfunded, and you can't be effective without money at a certain point. So hopefully ponying up this $100 million lets people know that you can spend money and it's not the worst thing in the world. But yeah, that's what I think.
I'd also add to that, again, all the good bills pass, all the bad bills are stopped, and that we see a legislative report card that better reflects the things we care about. We have a 2018 legislative report card, and if most of your report cards look like this, I don't think you'd be too happy. And we're looking at a lot of the issues that span all of the environmental issues, so looking at bills that worked on lands, water, wildlife, public health, climate, and most of, a lot of our representatives and our senators failed. They might vote really well on air quality issues, but then when it comes to climate change, for some reason, they flip their votes. So I think a more reflective legislative report card, and then also remembering that sometimes after our session, a lot of the bills are then leveraged at the federal level to try and pass greater legislation. So we're always trying to, those are implications. So stopping it here, opposing bad bills, and putting through good things can also then filter up into the federal legislation. So we want to just be mindful that we work really hard at the state level, that our state bills and legislative session truly reflects the values of Utahns, because we don't want to see it go anything bad go any further than the state. So
For me, the biggest problem that we face in the future, So Utah's cities, Utah's municipalities, are the number one highest per person water users in the United States. And it's been that way for decades. And that's because the Division of Water Resources hasn't made water conservation a really high priority. What they've made a high priority is $5 to $6 billion in new spending for the proposed Lake Powell pipeline and proposed Bear River development. And both of those massive water projects will make Utah poorer. It will subjugate all other spending needs, education, air quality, transportation beneath it, because that $6 billion in spending is so massive relative to the state economy. And so the agency that is proposing these essentially boondoggle water projects is advancing them as quick as they can. They've spent about $30 million on each one of these projects to advance them under the guise that we're running out of water. And yet the reality of the situation is that, like I said, we're the number one highest per person water user in the country. And it's been that way for decades. And so they're also in charge of water conservation, and they've made water conservation a very low priority. So we think that's a major problem. We anticipate more spending bills to advance Lake Powell Pipeline and Bear River development. They've already started saying that we can't spend more money on other things like roads and education because of these water projects. So there could be some nasty infrastructure bill that's their water infrastructure bill under the guise of this crisis that we're running out of water. The reality of the situation is that 85% of the water in Utah is used by agriculture. Our cities only use about 8% of the water in the state, and most of that's for grass outside our buildings. We're not really in a water crisis, but our rivers and stream are in a crisis because as we increase our air temperatures from climate change, we shrink our snowpacks. Doing that means less water in our streams, and our fish and wildlife species suffer. So what we have is this one agency, frankly, with too much power and far too many lobbyists at the State House pushing $6 billion in spending right now under this manufactured idea that we're in a crisis.
You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. If you're just joining us, Today it's a preview of the upcoming legislative session featuring voices from Utah's environmental community. In this final segment, panel members take questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Hi, thank you for being here. We saw in 2018 some successful citizen initiatives. Do you foresee any environmental issues that your organizations deal with that could become a citizen initiative at some point in time?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but that's because these great ideas haven't been told to me yet. They come from people like this and groups like, you know, the students we had last year who brought forward that climate initiative. So really, hopefully, the lesson that was learned from that is that it starts with an idea and it starts with making relationships, and that can move forward. So I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but it's certainly always a possibility.
So my question kind of is relate to like federal legislation. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been talking about getting the Green New Deal passed with a bunch of other members of the Justice Democrats caucus. Would you guys ever lobby for something like that, like let's say to get Ben McAdams on board or one of our other representatives to support legislation similar to that, or do you guys only focus with state level stuff?
So Heal Utah mostly focuses on state level stuff. If you're not familiar with the group called the Citizens Climate Lobby, that's really exactly what they do, is they're concerned citizens who volunteer to get federal representatives on board with climate change initiatives, and that's exactly what they do. So it'd be a great group to work out, to reach out to, and I know they've come out in support of the new Green Deal or Green New Deal, and other legislation like that.
And with the Sierra Club, we are the local Utah chapter, but we do have the national organization. So we do work, at the Utah level, we work as liaisons between Utah and our federal policy folks. So that is something we would support and help with. We help work with our federal policy folks to create those relationships. So there is that opportunity.
Utah Rivers Council does go to D.C. periodically, and we do lobby in Congress. It's really hard. A lot of bandwidth is required to make an impact there. You know, we'd be careful. I'm nervous anytime federal legislation is put together because oftentimes in the deal-making, some toxic elements get added to the legislation. So, you know, we have a problem with water, and that water infrastructure, everybody, you know, that sounds great and benign. Like, who doesn't want water infrastructure? But when it starts having environmental laws, exemptions to environmental laws and environmental reviews, and we start having really bad water projects added to that under the guise of infrastructure, that's when we get concerned. But not having reviewed the legislation, I can't speak to that.
I've heard that the governor, I believe, signed legislation that to reduce the rebates, tax rebates, and quotas for electric cars in Utah.
Yeah, so unfortunately, a piece of legislation that passed last year included an element which increased the registration fees on electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles. So that was bad, and that did happen, and we saw it happen at a time when we need more electric vehicles on the Wasatch Front to help address this problem. I mentioned that air pollution number comes from transportation earlier, so that's huge. And, you know, at the beginning, all these technologies need a little assistance to get going, and instead of seeing that, we saw us go in the opposite direction. So we'll continue to try to work on that in the future.
I wanted to ask the panel about the partisan nature of Utah. So this is a red state. Carly's from the Sierra Club, which tends to have a lot more success with working with Democrats. There are also ideas thrown out about either free public transportation or heavily subsidized. Things like that tend to not be as popular in red states. So is all this just like high in the sky, or is there like meaningful ways that this can actually be enacted in Utah?
Is that a question for the whole panel?
Yeah, anyone.
Yeah, so I'm sure Carly wants to respond from the Sierra Club's perspective. You know, there is this kind of idea that environmental leaning groups are blue, are left. But the reality of the situation is that, you know, anything about protection, anything about conservation is conservative. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was, coined this idea of conservation. And a number of conservatives have been very strong conservationists. So I think all three of us work to be as bipartisan as possible. You know, sometimes we get this reputation, especially by layman legislators who've never actually talked to anybody from anything remotely like an environmental group. And they're like, wow, you know, you have all these economic arguments, all these fiscal arguments. You know, you're thinking about dollars and cents. And ironically, what we find a lot of times in the state house is that a lot of Republicans are actually not acting very fiscally conservative. So Utah Rivers Council has been working with on our legislation with Republicans and Republican sponsors literally for decades. And some of our fiscal conservative partners up there, we work a lot bipartisanly. And one of them said to me, I won't say who it was, but one of them said to me, look, you know, a lot of this body definitely has an R after it. But the reality is that there's a lot of social conservatives up there, and there actually aren't that many fiscal conservatives. There's a lot of fiscal conservatives among the Democratic Party. There's a lot of fiscal conservatives in the Republican Party, but they're not synonymous. And so I think what happens with voters is they vote for Republicans because they think they're getting a fiscal conservative out of it. But the reality is that a lawn sign dialogue doesn't do that. And so we see a lot of disconnect. The conversation just a moment ago that Noah had was having about these new technologies. I mean, you know, we talk about these new technologies and somehow we're like, oh, we're propping them up. But then when we come around to coal, suddenly we can throw $100 million at that and we don't look at that as propping it up. That's putting people to work. Well, the same is true with these new technologies. I mean, it's putting people to work. So I think that the trick, that the advice I would give to everybody is to just don't put yourself into that label because it doesn't mean anything. I mean, I'm a fiscal conservative, and we have a lot of members that represent the full economic and political spectrum that are part of our constituency.
Yeah, just to echo what Zach said, you know, we're in Utah. We don't get to choose what legislators we work with. We don't get to, there's no easy route. And some of our biggest allies over the years have been Republicans. Representative Becky Edwards was a Republican, and she ran the climate resolution. So it's really just one of the themes you can tell is establishing relationships. And establishing those relationships, whether they're Republican or Democrat, you don't want to box people in. We have surprising allies up there, and an enemy on today's issue might be your biggest champion on tomorrow's issue. So it's our goal as an organization and for, you know, anybody who's civically engaged, if your representative is a Republican and you think that they're not going to listen to you, it's give them something to think about, help change their mind through relationship and dialogue. If they're a Democrat, we can't just assume they're on board with everything. They need education too, and we need to persuade someone to go from, you know, a potential ally to a champion of the issue.
Yeah, I would definitely echo what they both said as well. And then also, just thinking about from Sierra Club standpoint as well, going and working in different communities and making sure that we're helping amplify the voices that should be the lead voice on a particular issue. Because recognizing that maybe sometimes our name doesn't carry much weight in a relationship or in a conversation, but helping to amplify the voices that the issue is impacting, or, you know, we want to make sure that our communities feel like they're being heard and they're represented. And if we can just be a resource, we're happy to do that. And I think that is how we see a lot of change from that community organizing perspective, are those citizen initiatives where people are bringing the issue from their community to their representative, and forcing that listening session to happen. And we really believe in that as well.
Thank you. To just wrap up, I want to reemphasize these three dates that are up on the slide deck. These are lobbying workshops put on by Utah Rivers Council, but I believe February 7th is a co-lobbying session with Sierra Club and Utah Rivers Council. Additionally, I'm sure HEAL Utah has several lobbying training sessions as well. That information is out on flyers outside the door when you walk out. Also, there's a sign-up sheet out there for Utah Rivers Council, but if you put your name down on that, it will get to HEAL Utah and Sierra Club as well. So if you're interested in learning more or staying involved, please put down your email. Anything else you guys want to add?
Thanks so much. Yeah, this
was a blast. Well, thanks, everyone. Please join me in thanking our guests for an interesting and informative forum.
That's Jayla Lundstrom, moderating the discussion at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on January 14th, 2019. The title of today's forum, The State of the Environment, 2019 Legislative Priorities. If you'd like to hear the full discussion, as well as other Hinckley forums, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.